Welcome to Into the Mythic. I'm Leanne O'Donnell, and I'd love you to join me on this podcast series, which is really a journey into the mists of Irish mythology and folklore. Over the past few months, I've been working with Paul O'Colman, who, along with being a poet and a musician and a passionate teacher of the Irish language, is also a great lover of Irish mythology. And together, we've been exploring and discussing some of the stories from what is a very rich and ancient tradition. Maybe you've heard some of these tales in school or at home. If you're Irish, you almost certainly will have. But we're trying to come to these stories with fresh ears and open hearts and minds to see what ancient truths we can rediscover in the telling and in the listening. In the last episode, we explored a tragic and romantic love triangle and saw how honour and pride exacted a terrible price from the main characters. This week, I'm keen to explore another story with similar themes, but a different kind of love, brotherly love, the love between two men who grew up together but ended up on opposing sides of a war. And so, into the mythic we go.
The story we're going to deal with today is one very small part of a major saga, which is deeply and densely layered and has many, many tangential stories and backstories and side stories and so on. But this particular story that we've honed in on is a story of two men, one of whom is the hero of the entire story and another who emerges during the course of the story, who is the equal of this warrior, and they are foster brothers. But from the very start, we're aware that this is a tragedy of great proportions, and one of the biggest tragedies within this story is the inevitable meeting of the two young warriors who have to face off in single combat: Cuchulainn, the great champion and the hero of the story, and his foster brother, beloved blood brother, friend, lifelong friend, companion, and so on. Ferdia is the only person who is militarily or physically equal to Cuchulainn, who has the same battle craft. They were both trained by Scahach, the great female warrior up in the west coast of Scotland, the islands of Scotland. They were both trained by her. So they know each other's tricks. They've been trained by the same warrior genius, and they're equal in all things except one crucial part, which we'll come to.
So these two men are in different armies, though they have grown up as foster brothers together in a fosterage system in ancient Ireland that was really important part of the community and the culture, wasn't it?
It was, yes.
Your foster brothers were your brothers.
It was a way of making very strong links with people all around the kingdom and even other kingdoms, so that at times of severe need, you knew someone, you knew them by name, you knew them by face, you loved them, so you could approach them and say, look, let's sort this out, or we need your help, or whatever.
So it's actually a way of avoiding wars,
yes,
and needless battles by having these alliances and this kind of emotional connection with somebody.
Absolutely. In a very, very warlike society, they came up with ways of avoiding that. One was that system of fosterage.
So they were really, really close,
yes,
these guys.
Yeah.
And you're going to tell me now, give me a bit of background to how it happened that they ended up on opposing sides of this mortal combat. Yeah.
There were two main kingdoms in Ireland at that stage. This would have been about 500 BC or so. And Connacht in the west of Ireland was one, and Ulster in the northeast of Ireland was the other. And Conor was the king of Ulster, and Maeve was the queen. So the leading personage in Connacht was Maeve, was a woman. And she was quite incredible and extraordinary and very interesting woman who would stop it. She was quite ruthless, but brilliant and beautiful as well.
Of course, she had to be beautiful as well as brilliant.
Of course.
Okay, so brilliant, beautiful Queen Maeve, who was the Queen of Connacht, one of the major kingdoms of,
yes,
Ireland at the time. 1,500 years ago, we're talking about. Oh, no, 2005?
2005, about, yes.
2,500 yeah. years ago, a long time ago.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. And she and her husband, Alil, her consort, because she was the queen, they're after lovemaking one morning between the sheets, they start slagging each other, chiding each other. And she mentions that he's a kept man, and he bristles at that and says, I have more than yourself. You didn't bring as much to the marriage as I did. And she bridles at that. So they begin to count everything. And he's trying to backtrack them because it's kind of gone too far. But Maeve, once she starts, she can't be gainsaid. So they tot up everything, every single possession. And it turns out, to Alil's sort of secret delight, but also chagrin, that he's got one thing more than Maeve has in terms of possessions, and that's this beautiful bull, a white bull. And so Maeve is really annoyed at this.
So Maeve doesn't say, oh, okay, dear, you win that particular argument, I'll do the washing up.
No, exactly. She decides she has to get a bull equal to his, if not better than his. So they scour the country and they find that there is a bull in the province of Ulster, way, way over. And it's in an area called Cooley, a little peninsula just north of the town of Dundalk nowadays. And so she sends MacRath, her messenger, to go and negotiate to rent or buy the bull.
So this is a bull that would be the match of Adil's bull, and then they would at least be equal, and she could hold her head high around the dinner table. Okay.
Now, in the sagas to this, there's a fascinating side to this, that the two bulls who are a match, or which are a match to each other, that they are the final incarnation of two ancient druids who have shape-shifted time and time again in their battle to best each other. And the final incarnation is as these two magnificent bulls. So there's the Finbenach, the white-flanked bull, and there's the Don, the brown bull of Cooley.
Oh, amazing. So it's not just any old bull.
No, it's not at all. And nothing in these sagas, they tend to be told as simple nowadays as a simple story, but they're so complicated, complex, so layered that it's nearly impossible to synthesize them, really.
So from a symbolic or representational point of view, the bull represents wealth, and, you know, having a bull is a practically important thing. A good bull will give you a good herd.
Sure. Yes.
But on a whole other level, it represents this reincarnated druid.
Yes,
so
this exactly.
Ancient druidic tradition.
Yeah.
I like this idea, which I hadn't known before, that there's a whole other layer of a story, which is that the bulls have their own narrative process because they are part of this reincarnation cycle of these very powerful druids.
Yeah.
Okay, so this multi-layered already, and we haven't even got to our main characters yet. Well, our main characters.
Yeah, so she hasn't even put in her bid yet for the down, for the brown bull of Cooley. So MacRath, her messenger, who is the messenger in all these stories, he heads over to Cooley, and he's welcomed, of course, and he sits in and they have a big feast, and then they get down to negotiation, and the men from Cooley are happy to take the offer, the very generous offer that Maeve has made, to rent their bull, or to take their bull for a period of time. Because, of course, bulls would be let out to different farmers and so on. So this is just on a larger scale, going to a kingdom. So they're very happy with that. But then the drink flows freely and MacRath gets a bit drunk. And at some stage he lets slip the backup plan and says, well, you know, you boys are lucky that you rented the bull, because if you hadn't, we would have come and taken it. So then the Cooley boys, of course, their hackles rise and they say, right, so away with you. And he's sent off with a flea in his ear and without the bull. So Maeve then, of course, to protect her honour, has to go and get the bull. So she raises her army of 14,000 men, whether that's true or just an old story exaggeration, but it's obviously an enormous army for the time, heads off all the way across Ireland to go and get the bull.
So this is one of those wars that has a really sensible origin point, where they're fighting about, not only are they fighting about who has the biggest bull, they're fighting about, well, thanks for renting it to us, because if you hadn't, we'd have stolen it. And then somebody takes umbrage and says, well, you can't have it now. Okay,
yes,
so this is really an insight into human nature, as it was 2,500 years ago and probably is today.
Yeah.
So the battle is laid out, they head off.
Yeah, so they head off, and it's known exactly what way they went, because it's mentioned in the saga. So they headed through various well-known places today, and they arrived up at Cooley. Now, the bull has been hidden in all kinds of glens and valleys, because they know that Maeve is coming. To this day, there's a place called Barnavave, the Gap of Maeve, there in Cooley, and it was just below that the bull was hidden. So there are place names that exist there to this day because of, based on this story. And eventually they find it anyway, and they take the bull, and the men from Cooley, of course, are in no position to stop. There's just a small bunch of them and a huge army. But the reason that King Conor and the Ulster army doesn't rise up to fight them and defend them, because they were very powerful and very strong, is due to an ancient curse which afflicts all the men of Ulster at its time of greatest need. They suffer birthing pangs, the birthing pangs of a woman.
So there's a curse upon them that means they're presumably unable to fight because they're in labour, essentially.
Yeah, for a set number of days, they suffer the terrible pangs of labour because one of them put a woman through that and she cursed them. It's basically the story. But as with all these old stories, there's a loophole, and it's that it's any man who can grow a beard. So this means that Cuchulainn, who is the champion of Ulster but is precocious and extremely young for this job, he hasn't yet grown a beard. So he isn't afflicted by these pangs. So it's up to him to defend or to go and chase after and try and get the bull back. So they're heading back. The army is streaming back westwards, and he is chasing them, trying to slow them down long enough so that before they get over the great river Shannon and into their Connacht fastness, the Ulster men will have recovered and have come to the rescue.
So one young man, teenager, who cannot yet grow a beard, Cuchulainn, chases after 14,000 soldiers. Yes. To get this bull back.
Yeah. Now, he's a bit of a genius in a military sense. And there are lots of stories about his childhood and his youth and the amazing feats which he can perform. So he's not typical or normal. Like in a very battle-like, warlike society, warrior society, he stands metaphorically head and shoulders above everybody. To get back to the story, Cuchulainn manages to get ahead of the army, which is streaming west back to Connacht, and he gets to a ford that he knows they have to cross, and he meets them there, and he stops them and challenges them on their honour to single combat. So that means the army can't move forward until a single combat has taken place, or until he loses, until he's killed. So the army puts up a champion to fight Cuchulainn. And this was a standard policy in those days, that a king or a leader would put forward a champion. And this was a way of avoiding massive bloodshed or more bloodshed, because if you just put up one from each side in a playoff, then the champion that wins, his side carries the day and the other accepts defeat and goes home. And while a battle is on, the army is not allowed to move. So they have to stay still. So every time there's a battle, the army stops moving west. So precious time for Maeve is ticking away, because in a certain number of days, the Ulster men will be back up on their feet and they'll be howling for blood and coming after them. So she's a bit desperate and the army is getting desperate, but he stands firm and nobody can beat him.
Extraordinary. Absolutely amazing. And does he get tired? Do we have any sense of
it? Oh, he does. Yeah? Yes, he gets tired. He gets wounded. He gets damaged. Sometimes he goes home to Dundalgan, to his place, to Emer, his wife, and she sews up his wounds, and there are doctors and who look after him. And so the army is creeping westward. So, this every now and again they make a bit of headway, but then he rushes back and stops them again at another ford, at another spot. So they're all getting fed up with this. Days have passed of fighting, Cuchulainn fighting this almost rearguard action, but holding them, stopping them, preventing them move forward. The army is beginning to get, the army of Maeve is beginning to get panicky, because they're a long way from home. They're still only in county, they're still in the same county as the county in which they stole the bull. They haven't even made it out of that, and that's the smallest county in Ireland. So they're only 20, 30 miles down the way, and the Ulster men will be waking soon and coming after them. So mutiny is being whispered. Maeve is getting fed up. Nobody wants to face Cuchulainn in single combat. So things have come to a serious state at this stage.
And so nobody wants to face him because he beats everybody.
Exactly. He has beaten everyone. He's beaten all the best. But returning from a long overseas visit is Ferdia. And Ferdia is a foster brother and blood brother of Cuchulainn. They trained together under the woman warrior Scathach up in the Isles of Scotland. They learned pretty much all the same stuff. They lived together, slept together, ate together, fought together. They have a blood pact not to fight against each other. And
oh, they have a pact not to fight.
Yes, yeah, they've sworn an oath not to fight each other. And Ferdy arrives back from far overseas in the Far East. It's hinted, because he's wearing this suit of armour that's made from beautifully wrought bone. It has a name, like a lot of the armor and weapons in these stories have, and the name means bone or bony. So it's made of layers and layers and layers of bone, which is very, very strong. But he arrives back, begins to hear the news about his beloved Cuchulainn, and is really delighted. But he's in the army of Maeve.
He's delighted because Cuchulainn is doing well?
Because Cuchulainn is doing brilliantly and becoming an even greater hero than ever. So he's delighted for his brother. But also he's keeping a low profile because he's aware that everyone is aware that he's the only one who could match Cuchulainn in battle. So he's not catching anyone's eye. He's not going near Maeve. He's keeping around the back of the camp, so to speak. And Maeve has a big powwow one evening with all her top leaders, because nothing has worked. The army are beginning to panic. Some of the generals come and say the army is ready to run at the slightest thing. So she says, we've got to find someone. Who can there be? And she keeps at them and at them and at them, and then realises that they're evading an issue. And the reason they're evading it is because they know Ferdia won't fight Cuchulainn. But eventually they admit that the one person who could challenge Cuchulainn and match him is this man, Ferdia.
And here we have another moment in the narrative where we all see what's going to happen.
So Maeve sends for Ferdia.
And can I just say, we know what's going to happen partly because we understand that Maeve doesn't take no for an answer.
Maeve never takes no for an answer.
So we may know what should happen here, which is that they shouldn't be put up against each other. But this is the queen who has just gone across the country to take a bull to settle an argument with her husband.
Yeah.
So she's not going to, if she knows that Ferdia is the answer to her problems, she's going to find a way. Is what I'm guessing.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. And whenever Maeve, it's quite funny really, but when Maeve is making a deal with somebody during this saga, and she'll say, I'll offer you a certain number of cows and a certain number of heifers and three large bulls and certain acreage of land and this gold brooch and my own friendly thighs on top of it is always the clincher.
I can imagine it is the clincher, quite literally. And what does somebody say in response?
Oh, they just say yes. Fair enough, Maeve.
I can't say no to that. Yeah. Maeve, beautiful and brave, who will not be gainsaid.
And at one stage, she even befuddles and tricks, because she's a very clever woman too. Now, she doesn't come out of it this very well, even though you have to admire her brilliance, her political genius and her leadership ability. But she's ruthless, and she doesn't have the same sense of honour as some of the leading people. But most of them fall victim to her, and they lose their honour along the way. The only one who doesn't fall to anything is Cuchulainn. So she summons Ferdia to her tent, and he has to go, so he turns up. But he knows the reason for it, and he sits down, and he's quite obdurate and clear, and but she's very clever, and she knows that he knows that's why he's here. So she doesn't talk about that for a long time, and she brings in her beautiful, desirable daughter, who's already been used as bait before, the white-browed Findelar, and she plies him with wonderful drink, great food, there's music, she flatters him, she talks to him. Findavar is beside him, touching his hand, kissing his lips, filling his wine goblet. And Ferdia, although actually it's because of his certainty that he falls into the trap, because he's certain of his honour, he's certain that he loves Cuchulainn, he's sure that he'll never fight him. So he thinks, I don't have to worry about this. So he gets drunk. He allows himself to get drunk, to be inveigled, to be...
Oh, well, can we just pause on that? Because that is just the most wonderful and sad kind of narrative moment, where it's the hero who is absolutely certain of their own honour that eventually gets tricked.
Yes, yeah.
So he's like, I can go in and I can talk to the queen and I can take the drink from the beautiful daughter because I know myself and I know that I won't break my vow here and break my love for my foster brother. I know myself. I can trust myself.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh, that's so sad already.
Yes.
So what happens? How do they get him to do it though?
He just reckons without Maeve's scheming and the power of the drink and the power of desire for Findavar. But Maeve very, very cleverly tricks him into believing that Cúchulainn has said things about him. Because when he refuses to do it, she says, yes, yes, no, that's fine. Absolutely, no, I'm not angry, even though she was raging. She says, no problem. He was right, though. And he says, what do you mean he was right? Who was right? And he said, well, Cúchulainn was right. And he said, what? And she says, no, nothing. And he said, no, what was it? So then she apparently reluctantly tells him that Cúchulainn said, yeah, he wouldn't come and fight me. He knows I'd best him. So then he gets annoyed with that. So it's all, she gets him in every weakness, at every possible spot.
But the idea that he was chicken, kind of, or too cowardly, yes, to fight, yeah, him. And the worst thing in the world would be the sense that your beloved blood brother thought you were,
yes, yeah,
too weak and too cowardly to face him.
Yeah. And then he gets really angry. He leaves. He's going to do it. He's given all kinds of, you know, a huge amount of promises, including the hand of the daughter, the beautiful daughter. But even in a way, in a kind of angled way, the kingship in the future, because she gives him this brooch that has been passed down for generations from king to queen to king to queen, and she possesses it at the moment. And it's not, she has no right to give him this, but Maeve always just goes ahead, does what needs to be done, and then, you know, with the view of, I'll sort this out later. And of course, she usually doesn't have to, because whatever she's promised people in the past, she hasn't had to deliver, because they've ended up dead by Cúchulainn's hand.
So she promises now and worry about it later.
Exactly, yes.
Wow. So I feel, I have this sense of Ferdiad. So he's come back from wherever he's been in the Far East, and he's this potent, powerful young man on the way up, and he's wearing his beautiful armour, and he knows one thing about himself, which is that he can trust his own honour, and he knows that he would never harm his blood brother, Cúchulainn. And he finds himself in this situation, basically way out of his depth.
Yeah.
And she throws everything at him, including the ancestral brooch.
Yes, yeah.
Dear God. Wow.
So that night, he spends a bad night, because he knows he's done wrong. He knows he's made a wrong decision.
Somewhere in the middle of this night,
yes,
with the drink and,
yeah,
the
towards
flirting,
the end of it, he agrees that he's going to go and sort Cúchulainn out, especially because Cúchulainn has been bad-mouthing him, according to Maeve. But he knows that he's wrong to do this, but he won't admit it to himself. So he works up in a rage of moral indignation to keep him going. And then he heads off early the next morning to approach Cúchulainn, who's waiting at the ford. And
so is he hungover, is what I'm thinking?
Yeah, he's hungover. And actually, he has a long sleep on the bank, because he goes so early that he needs to sleep. And he gets his charioteer makes a bed for him, and he lies down, and he tells him to watch out for Cúchulainn when he comes and wake him as soon as he comes. And then he manages to fall asleep then.
OK, it's getting more and more real and human to me as,
yes,
I think of him kind of shamefaced, hungover. What have I done? And yet trying to defend the fact that he's done it to himself.
Yes.
So definitely he needs a nap.
Yeah. So he sleeps it off a bit, and he bounces back, because he's a young, very, very fit young athlete, you know. And Cúchulainn arrives and is shocked to see him before him, facing him, because he knows what's going to happen. And Ferdiad feels shame, of course, because he's there. So instead of greeting him properly, he taunts him. He throws a barb across the river at him, a verbal barb, and Cúchulainn is hurt at that and says, I would have thought the only greeting I would want this morning would be one from you, my beloved Ferdy. Instead, you're hurting me this way. How could you do this? And just because they threw a woman at you, you know, do you think she's the first? Do you think you're the first she's ever looked on or been promised to? And that really gets it works against his plan, because it makes Ferdiad really bristle and feel slighted and feel stupid that he's fallen for the oldest trick in the book, if you like. So he gets very angry then, and they both then get angry with each other. And then Cúchulainn calms everything down a bit and says, look, we don't have to do this. And Ferdiad says, we do. And Cúchulainn realizes, we do.
Oh,
Ferdiad cannot get out of this. If he goes away, he'll be shamed. If he fights and doesn't fight to the best of his ability, he'll be dead and shamed. If he kills Cúchulainn, he'll feel shame. So he's just up against the wall.
He's absolutely trapped, isn't he?
He's completely trapped, and all he can do now is fight.
And just that exchange across the river, I feel slightly agog, because you could write that set in 2022.
Yes.
A story of two guys going, well, why are you saying that to me now this morning when I haven't seen you for ages, and you can absolutely see how by saying the wrong thing and being irked and by slighting each other, they just kind of wound it up and wound it up.
Yeah.
But then Conan says, listen, don't worry about it. We'll let it go. Let's wind it down. But Ferdia realises he's in a trap.
Yeah. He just says, we can't. We have to go. We have to move forward. The only way is into this battle. And Cuchulainn realised the truth of that, because if one thing Cuchulainn understands, it's honour. And it's inescapable in this case.
And is Ferdia right? Is that the only thing he could have done?
Well, it is really, under those circumstances, in that social order, because he would have been disgraced. It would have, if he had left, even gone back to the Far East, it would have followed him in some way. And he would have known, felt inside himself, you know, this is a society that preferred death to dishonour. So there's no other way out of this.
Or certainly, if there was, it wouldn't be the story we'd be talking about now.
No, it wouldn't. Well, I suppose the only other way out would be that Cuchulainn runs away, but he's not going to do that, because his honour will impel him. And not only his honour, but his, well, it is his honour, but not only his feeling of pride, but he also has an honour to defend his province, his kingdom, the kingdom of Ulster. So he has even a bigger honour to uphold. So he's not going to back down. And as we know, Cuchulainn doesn't. He never lets his honour down. He always acts in an honourable fashion.
So the stage is set
For tragedy.
The inevitable
is
unfolding. And I wonder again, is the real message in this very intricate, very human story, that the price of honour is sometimes too high to pay?
Yeah.
So what are the rules? How do they do this then? How do they go about it?
So it's single combat in the river, because they Cuchulainn holds the east side of the ford, and the Connacht army are on the west side. So they come into the river and they fight. Cuchulainn allows Ferdia to choose weapons because he's the challenger. So he chooses weapons for that day, and they throw darts and sharp spheres, discs at each other, and short weapons. They do that for a long time, but they realise that's not getting anywhere because they're just too skilled. So then they switch to javelins.
And they're in the river?
They're in the river, and yes, throwing them at each other.
Which river?
The river Dee, which flows through RD as it is now. And then night falls. So they realise, okay, we're not going to do much damage at this range, and it's over now. The night is falling, so they rush to each other and clasp themselves in each other in a deep embrace for long moments. And you know, the whistle is blown. They run in and they're hugging each other and hugging, because they haven't seen each other for a long, long, long time. And they go way back, and then their horses are paddocked together. The charioteers sit around the same fire. They share the same food, and then they lie they wrap the two cloaks around them, and they sleep together on the ground. And then in the morning they get up and they separate and they go to the other side of the river. First day ends in a draw. The second day ends in a draw, but a bit more damage. That night the doctors come, the physicians come, and each of the warriors sends half of his medicines to the other, to his friend, because they love each other so much. They eat together. Their horses are corralled together that night. The charioteers sit around the same fire together, and they sleep together in the same cloak. And the next morning they get up.
So, I mean, I just feel the need to pause on that, even though what you've said explains it all perfectly. But it's highly evocative, isn't it? This idea that they're battling away, and then as soon as night falls, as soon as the whistle blows, there's no enmity. There's the opposite of enmity.
Yes,
there's
yeah.
How can I help you? And here, take some of my medicine, and let's sleep together and keep each other warm.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. They love each other, and it's what makes it so tragic. If they hated each other, if they were nasty to each other all the way through, it wouldn't be as bad. But this really gets you in the heart.
And they must know. They know themselves.
Oh, they do.
They
yes.
know where
yeah.
this is going.
Yeah, and they understand each other. And Cuchulainn understands that Ferdia is stuck, and Ferdy understands he's stuck and understands that Cúchulainn understands him, and that makes it worse.
So on the third day, they get up again.
They get up, and it's swords this time, because they said, we're not going to settle anything from a distance. So they go at each other with their two-sided swords, and they hack lumps out of each other.
So that's even worse, because there was a bit of distance, and they were throwing darts.
It gets closer and closer. So now it's hand-to-hand.
And hand-to-hand now with swords.
Yep.
So they're up against their dearest friend, their blood brother.
Yep. And equal match. They've always been equally matched. So they fight and fight. The river is flowing red with the blood. It says in the stories there are gobbets and bits of flesh flying everywhere. And everyone, the women and children leave at this stage. They can't watch anymore. But it's so terrible. And then night comes. But this night, this is the third night, they don't sleep together. They don't eat together. The horses are not together. They go back to either side of the river because they both sense it's coming to an end. Ferdia feels worse about it because he knows it's his fault. It's his fault, this whole thing. And they also know that on the morrow, one of them is going to die and the survivor is not going to feel good about it.
So they know it's beginning to come to an end, that they can't go on like this, that they've hurt each other too much at this point.
Yeah.
Even to sleep together.
Yes.
Which is a very painful metaphor, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
The relationship could withstand a certain amount of pain, but then on this last day, they just have hurt each other too much.
Yeah. And they go into battle, and Ferdius begins to get the upper hand. Cúchulainn has asked, has instructed his charioteer, Laeg, who's kind of the right-hand man, to chide him. If he starts to fall back, to call insults at him, so Laeg starts to do that, and he recovers a bit, and they're really doing serious damage to each other. Now, prior to the battle, when they put on their finest weapons, because they need their finest clothes, silk shifts, and bright armour and jewel-encrusted helmets and so on, because they know the world is watching at this stage and this is going to be the end. So they want to end at the best. So their hair is done, their beards are braided, everything. Well, Ferdia's beard is braided and everything looks wonderful. Under his armour, under the bone armour, Ferdia has put this huge adamantine stone, because he knows about this spear that Cúchulainn has called the Gaebulga. And this is a spear that was given. It's an ancient spear that has barbs. And the barbs, when it pierces, it never misses. If you know how to use it, you throw it with your foot, not your hand, with your big toe and the next toe, and you fling it upwards, and it pierces the body. And then each barb splits up into seven other barbs, and they into seven. Each one of those into seven others. So it kind of explodes inside the person. And at the end of it, it has to be cut out of the dead body, because nobody survives this.
So now, is it a supernatural device?
It is, yes.
Yeah, it's magic.
It's a weapon of serious, serious power. And this was taught to Cúchulainn by Scahach, but Ferdia wasn't taught this skill. And he knows this. This is why he puts on the sword over his most vulnerable area, because that's where the spear will be coming upwards. So he has it down over his groin to stop it, because he knows that at some stage Cúchulainn might call on this.
So he knows that they're equally matched, but that Cúchulainn has something that he doesn't have. He has a skill and he has a spear.
Yeah. They're battling away, and then Ferdia manages to get his sword right up under Cúchulainn's armour, right into his belly, and pierces him deeply. And Cúchulainn falls in the ford, and Ferdia is hacking at him with the sword, and he's fending it off. And then Cúchulainn calls to Laeg, his charioteer, to give him the Gaebulga, this spear. So Laeg puts it in the water, and it floats up to Cúchulainn, and he's fending off Ferdia with both arms, but he gets it with his foot, and he flings it, and it goes right through the adamantine stone, right through pierces the armour, the amazing armour, and right into Ferdia, who falls as it's exploding inside him. Immediately Cúchulainn jumps up and grabs him before Ferdia can fall, and holds him in his arms and carries him across to his bank so that he won't die with the Connacht army. And he holds him while his beloved friend and brother dies in his arms.
And he did it, and he knew he was killing him, and he knew it was going to be, he couldn't have possibly defended himself, right? Yeah.
No.
But he did it anyway, and then immediately leaps up to
carry him away.
And Cuchulainn gets up to fight another day.
He does, but he's seriously injured at this stage. The army is going to attack him as a mob at this stage, and Laeg hurries him up, gets him into his chariot, and they race back to his stronghold in order to evade them and to recover before attacking again. So things have turned and changed, but at this stage then the Ulster army begins to come to and chase them. So it's the beginning of the end now of the story.
At the risk of trying to simplify what is no doubt a very complicated ending to a very complicated story, Maeve has come all this way to get the bull, to win this particular argument. Cuchulainn has killed his best friend Ferdia, his blood brother. So who gets the bull?
Well, Maeve gets the bull over the Shannon River, which is the very broad river, which is the border, the boundary of her province. And she gets it over the river, but the two bulls sense each other and they immediately start to fight. So the army, Maeve's army, manages in the main to evade the Ulster. Now, the Ulster men fall on them and kill numberless people, soldiers, but the main body, including Maeve and Ali, will get over the river with the second bull to safety.
So they bring the second bull over.
So they've won in a way.
Yeah, so Cuchulainn has killed Ferdia at this point
for
nothing.
Yes, for nothing really. Yeah. Yes.
And once the bull that she has taken gets into the same territory as her husband's bull,
yes,
they sense each other.
They sense each other, these two ancient enemies, as we've mentioned, throughout all kinds of shapes and incarnations, and they attack each other. And the brown bull kills the white bull, eviscerates it. And
so the bull from Cooley, the bull that was taken and brought over the Shannon, kills
the Connacht bull.
The Connacht bull
kills it, and its entrails enter the water at the ford where they fight, and that's Athlone, the ford of the entrails, to this day a town in the middle of Ireland. And the brown bull heads off back towards Cooley, but dies along the way from its wounds in that battle. So neither bull survives.
So in Greek tragedy, that'd be a Pyrrhic victory.
Yes,
so
sure.
Cuchulainn beats Ferdia. The bull gets taken away anyway.
Yes. Yeah.
That seems like a victory until the bulls destroy each other, ultimately. The brown bull wins, but then dies from its wounds.
Yes.
So it's a pointless bloodbath at this point.
Exactly. Nothing has been gained except more enmity between the two provinces.
Okay, thank you, Paul, for that amazing story that I feel like I need to listen to about 5 times before I understand the true meaning behind it, because there's a huge amount in it, isn't there?
Oh, it's amazing. It's incredible.
But the main feeling now is of wasted life, wasted effort.
What's the point?
Yeah. What was the point of that? Yeah. And huge sorrow, really.
There's such tragedy in it. There's overweening pride. There's hubris as well. Like that's really... That was the only failing of Ferdia, really, that he went into that meeting with Maeve with hubris. He felt he was inviolate, he wouldn't fall, and he did. So there's so many human weaknesses are shown in this story.
But, you know, in his defence, he was probably very young and had thus far in his life been very honourable by a very straightforward code of honour.
Yes, always had been, yes.
Yeah, and just maybe just wasn't equipped for the level of complexity that was thrown at him.
And it could also, you know, it's the ancient battle between the warriors and the wily old politicians and the straight true warriors being tricked, manoeuvred, manipulated.
To their doom.
And against their most fervent beliefs.
And all for pretty much nothing, basically.
Yeah.
And I suspect that is why we're telling the story.
Yeah. 2,500 years later.
Into the Mythic is made possible by the generous support of Wild Goose Studios, a family-owned craft studio based in Kinsale, County Cork.